You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. Got coffee in hand in my stainless steel Breadbox Media cup. I've already had a nail in my foot this morning, but hey, we're all playing hurt this time of year. Great to be with you. 573-4-BREAD-4. 573-4-BREAD-4 is the number you can call or text anytime during the program here on Breadbox Media, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. This, the feast day of St. Dominic, founder of the Dominican Order, the Order of Preachers, and this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. I'm rejoicing in particular for a couple of guests I'm looking forward to talking to today. Here in about 30 minutes, we'll talk to Timothy Stanley. Timothy, who is a British historian and journalist, writes for the London Daily Telegraph, writes for CNN. You'll see him all over the place, the Catholic Herald. He was at the Republican convention. He is a longtime observer of American politics. Sometimes you need somebody from the outside to give you a true perspective. And we're going to talk about him and talk to him about politics and the presidential race, among other things. And interesting piece he has from this past Friday from the Telegraph, how the Republicans should deal with the Donald. And it talks about sort of a GOP crisis with a difficult candidate, reminiscent of the 1964 race where the Republicans nominated the very polarizing Barry Goldwater. So we'll get into that with Tim Stanley, some of his historical perspective. And then in the second hour, we're going to talk to Stacy Trasankos. She is a PhD chemist from Penn State University, or that's where she got her PhD anyway. She writes science homeschooling curricula, and she has an excellent blog on faith and science and has a great book actually coming out this fall called Particles of Faith. But we're going to talk to her about a piece that she wrote about the appropriate reaction that believers should have to the recent news that some scientists claim they have found the key to how life evolved from matter, right? That's always been sort of the big bugaboo in terms of evolutionary theory, right? Is how do you get from non-living things to living things? And there's a group that thinks they've maybe made a giant leap forward in understanding that, and they see it as a refutation of the God of the gaps. In other words, we no longer need God to explain why life came to be. Then there are Christians who react to that predictably and defensively. But Stacy Trasankos wants to advise a different option in our response, and you may be surprised by what you hear. So Stacy Trasankos in the second hour. Give you the question of the day in the next segment. Of course, we'll look back in history, spin the Dollar Catechism wheel, and give out our What Were You Thinking nominees. Other things we'll get into today, hopefully, if we've got time. Zika and the wrong question, a remarkable season for saints, and St. Sebastian sports and purposeful suffering, all that and more on the program today. Again, welcome your calls, 573-4-BREAD-4. I guess I should explain the whole stepping on a nail thing this morning. Oh my goodness. Evidently, I guess one of our kitchen chairs, you know, had one of those things in the bottom of it. You know how they have those little pads or things at the end of, on the bottom of chairs. So if they're on a hardwood floor, they won't scratch up the floor when they move around. I guess this one in the bottom of one of our chairs wasn't applied to the bottom of the chair with a sticky pad. It actually had about a half inch nail in it that went up into the chair leg. I guess somehow it had come out and come loose, didn't know it. Stepped right on that bad boy about 5 minutes before I was to leave to come up here, flush to the heel. Hope my tetanus is up to date. I guess you'll know when you turn on, I'm not on here, that something's gone wrong. But anyway, watched some Olympics last night. You know, I've been thinking, in fact, what I really thought about yesterday was how this weekend, in so many ways, it's about legacies, both in terms of sports and in terms of faith in life, because you had the Football Hall of Fame this weekend. You had, you know, people like Brett Favre welcomed in the NFL Hall of Fame. You had the Olympics, of course. Everybody's wanting to, I mean, you know what, these athletes, whether they're swimmers, whether they're runners, whether they're soccer players, you name it, gymnasts, they have meets and competitions all the time, right? It's not like they wait every 4 years to get together. But there's something about the Olympics. And in the Olympics, you make or break your legacy as an athlete. Winning that medal, that gold medal in particular, is something that they can never take away from you. So I thought about that a lot this weekend in terms of sports, with the Hall of Fame, with the Olympics. And I thought, in a sense, these are sort of like the Catholic Hall of Saints. You know, today the feast day of St. Dominic. We'll talk a little bit later about St. Dominic, who is a contemporary of St. Francis. And in many ways, Hall of Fames, gold medals, they're all about an athlete's legacy. What will endure after they have gone? And I thought about that in particular with the Olympics because, you know, the Olympics being held in Rio, I guess you could say you've got an Olympics being held in the most, at least a Summer Olympics, the most Catholic city it's been held in since, what, the 1968 Mexico City Games, and certainly the most Catholic in terms of its name and origin since maybe the 84 Los Angeles Games, maybe Barcelona in 92, I don't know. But watching the coverage of this, of course, not only do you have the sheer geographic beauty of the terrain there at Rio, just seeing Copacabana Beach and those mountains right on the coast, just absolutely gorgeous, despite some of the other perils that may be a part of life in Brazil. And not only that, you've got that spectacular statue, Cristo Redentor, that large statue of our Lord overlooking the city with arms wide open. There really is some great Catholic imagery and sensibilities. Not only that, you've got several athletes who I'm following who are evidently practicing Catholics. Katie Ledecky, who was dominant last night in the 400-meter freestyle race, that incredible performance. 19 years old, won gold at 15. Now she's got another gold at 19, practices her faith. Of course, I watched the women's gymnastics with my wife Angie last night. She loves the gymnastics. I can remember back in 1976 with Nadia Comaneci getting her perfect 10s. I was just a little 10-year-old boy mesmerized by it. And then watching last night Simone Biles, who's the pre-Olympic gold medal favorite. And she evidently is a practicing Catholic as well. And I'm sure there are more. But one of the things I discovered in reading about these Olympics in this very Catholic city is that St. Sebastian is the patron saint of athletes and also of the host city of Rio de Janeiro. In fact, I'm trying to find it here. I think the Rio de Janeiro's official name, the city's full name, is St. Sebastian of Rio de Janeiro, or St. Sebastian of the January River. So St. Sebastian, patron saint of athletes, the city of Rio is named for him. And so his presence looms over these Olympics. Well, who was St. Sebastian? Well, he's third century saint and martyr. He was from the area around Milan, was an early Christian. He is buried somewhere along the Appian Way, that great stone-paved Roman road that can still be traveled, most likely near or in the spot now occupied by the Basilica of St. Sebastian. St. Ambrose tells his story first, that Sebastian was deeply upset by Emperor Diocletian's persecution of Christians. So he joined the Roman army to help them from within. He hid his Christianity and became a member of the elite Praetorian Guard. But when Sebastian's Christianity was discovered, Diocletian took special interest in his punishment. He ordered Sebastian bound to a stake in a field where a group of archers shot him full of arrows. Ambrose described him looking like a sea urchin, and dozens of artists have depicted the saint like a pincushion. Still remember that episode, my favorite episode of The Simpsons ever, not that I've watched a ton, but when Bart and Homer were contemplating converting to the Catholic Church. Bart sent to a Catholic school because he was kicked out of his other school until the hip Irish young priest, no stereotypes here, gave him some copies of some saint comic books, and I think one of them had a picture of Saint Sebastian riddled with arrows on the front. Evidently, Saint Sebastian, though, survived. Irene of Rome, the widow of another Christian martyr, crept into the field at night to recover Sebastian's body and found him alive. She took him home and nursed him back to health. Of course, he would later die, beaten with clubs and dumped in a public sewer, again by Diocletian. But he is a patron saint of athletes and patron saint of these Olympics. So, Saint Sebastian, pray for us. And we'll talk a little bit more, maybe even in the next segment, about this whole idea of sports legacies, sainthood, how they all go together. Pretty amazing stuff. Maybe even get into a big announcement from the Yankees yesterday and more. We'll also have a question of the day about a celebrity birthday in the next segment. So hold on tight. Tim Stanley at the bottom of the hour. This is the Mike Allen Show, and you are listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to know more about Breadbox Media, this digital enterprise of evangelization, taking the good news of Jesus Christ and his love and the beauty and the richness of the faith he founded upon St. Peter and the apostles, the word Catholic meaning universal, the whole gospel for the whole world, every person, that statue towering over Rio with arms extended of our Lord. That's the nature of the church. With all-embracing arms, we proclaim that truth through digital streaming, through podcasting, through apps that you can geolocate your digital device. You can check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. If you want to check out our various contributors, just look at our show schedule. You can listen to podcasts through Podbean, Google Play, or iTunes. Subscribe to those, and you can discover all of our different contributors from coast to coast and across the fruited plain. Always something interesting coming out of Breadbox Media, so check it out. You can also become a friend of your favorite show. You can become a friend of this show, and through your monthly support, and receive exclusive online access to a special friend of the show webpage. So you can check that all out at breadboxmedia.com. My question of the day today has to do with Dustin Hoffman, who is celebrating his 79th birthday. Dustin Hoffman thinking about his own legacy, I'm sure, as he reaches the end of his 70s. I think we talked about him a number of months ago on the program. There was some sort of show on PBS about genealogies. Henry Louis Gates, who teaches at Harvard, who does genealogical work, discovering that Dustin Hoffman, his Jewish roots, of which his parents had kept him largely in the dark. And he really, for the first time in his life, as he reaches near the end of his life, Dustin Hoffman has a sense of who he really is. It's pretty cool. Anyway, I've always liked Dustin Hoffman as an actor, and that's my question of the day. What's your favorite Dustin Hoffman film here on your here on his birthday, 79 years old? 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. Still a lot of older Dustin Hoffman films I have not seen. I think the first Dustin Hoffman film I saw, I was still a kid, was Kramer versus Kramer. But one British website lists here his top 10 films. Many of these I have not seen, actually. Lenny comes in at number 10, which he faces. He plays Lenny Bruce. Let's see, Kramer versus Kramer coming in at number 9. And I know Dustin Hoffman, he actually won Best Actor for his role in that film. All the President's Men with Robert Redford. I'll tell you a funny Dustin Hoffman, Robert Redford story a little bit later in the program. Number 7, Rain Man, where he plays an autistic savant, really, along with his brother Tom Cruise. Number 6, Marathon Man. That's one I have not seen. I've always wanted to, if I can endure the dentist chair scene in that one. Papillon, another one I haven't seen, which I know is a favorite of many. Number 4, Tootsie. That's my favorite Dustin Hoffman film ever. Not only comedically hilarious, but I think some fine, fine filmmaking. And Bill Murray, as Dustin Hoffman's roommate, almost steals the show. Number 3, Midnight Cowboy. Number 2, Straw Dogs. And number 1, The Graduate, 1967. Wow, when Dustin Hoffman was, 30 years old, but played somebody fresh out of college. Again, my story about him and Robert Redford has to do with The Graduate. I'll share that a little later. So if you want to chime in on that, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, favorite Dustin Hoffman movie, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. Sports-wise, as I said, watched some Olympic coverage last night. And watched some of the swimming and some of the gymnastics. Now, I'm going to try to catch more of the Olympics than I did the London Games. I don't know why I didn't watch much of them. Maybe it was the time lag or time difference. But watching the gymnastics, seeing Simone Biles last night, who is 3-time world champion, trying to win Olympic gold, as I said, raised by her Catholic grandparents. Her mother was a drug addict. She was adopted by her grandparents, and they raised her, and they were devout Catholics, and she talked about that, how she prays the rosary and so forth, so that's pretty cool. And then watching Ledecky, the girl Katie Ledecky, last night dominate in the 400 meters, 19 years old. She's the one we talked about last week after her winning gold in 2012, took her gold medal by to see her teachers at her Catholic school, her little flower school that she grew up going to in Maryland. Also was fascinating to watch Dana Volman last night, who had won gold in 2012. Since then has had a baby, trying to become the first American Olympian after having a baby to get a medal, I think. And she got the bronze medal in her race, 100 meters. But she was very happy to get it. The world record broken by the Swede who won the thing. But I was pretty impressed with the coverage of Dana Volman and that celebration of her maternity. Thought that was a nice touch for the Olympics. So I'll be interested to watch the rest of this unfold. Again, as I said, Olympics all about legacy, just like the Hall of Fame this weekend when you have a Hall of Fame class with people like Marvin Harrison, Tony Dungy, for example. Kenny the Snake Stabler, inducted posthumously. And, of course, Brett Favre, who just played the game with such an unabashed joy. To watch the emotion of these gentlemen who were inducted into the Hall of Fame and the sense of that this is about legacy, as I said, that, to me, was sort of the theme of the weekend. Not just in sports and athletics, but in other things too. I mean, it's a feast day of a saint today, our canonization of saints. We, in a sense, did the Hall of Fame first, the Hall of Faith, those towering figures throughout the history of the church, not towering by their athletic ability necessarily or their political power, but towering because of their fidelity to the truth, whose names live on. There was a great quote I heard yesterday, actually in a beautiful story I saw on ESPN about a group of police officers working closely with the Washington Heights community in New York City, overcoming long violence and some animosity between law enforcement and the community, partnering together to, in this largely Dominican community, to build good relationships in a baseball league. But one of the officers whose friend had been gunned down there in the line of duty back in the late 80s, upon whom the whole baseball league and project was named in his memory, he said, "There, you die twice in life, when you actually die and when your name is said for the last time." That was a pretty powerful thing. You die twice, when you die and when your name is said for the last time. The beauty of the saints, of course, is that we continue to say their names, not simply in memory, but in confidence that there are friends who pray for us. Saint Sebastian, whose patronage looms over these games and the city of Rio, pray for us. So I was also struck by unfortunate legacies, like Alex Rodriguez, who, another sporting announcement this weekend, will play his last game with the Yankees on Friday, probably the last game he'll ever play in baseball, and how his legacy has sadly been tarnished and forever tainted by his decision to cheat. And in many ways, while life is not a dress rehearsal, we all have power over our legacy and over how our name will be uttered once we've departed. It's a matter of making choices with the free use of the liberty with which we have been blessed and the privilege and responsibility that comes with that. All right, let's sneak in a couple of What Were You Thinking nominees for the day. Let's see. Intoxicated man arrested after getting into police car. Toronto police said a man wandered into a police station garage and got into a cruiser. He thought it was a cab. Oh, boy. Surprise. An intoxicated man who got into a police cruiser thinking it was a cab has been arrested on an outstanding warrant, Toronto police say. As we say, go dumb or go home, you went dumb and you will not be going home for some time, evidently. Did he hop in the back of this police cruiser? "Yeah, I got you to take me to the corner of 5th and Washington." I guess the only thing worse, maybe, if he had, got in and tried to place some sort of fast food order. Your second nominee, we're going to say talk about legacies. New Jersey man's wife and girlfriend place side-by-side obituaries in the newspaper. This from reported by Fox News. Evidently, after this gentleman died, Leroy Black, two different women, side-by-side, same photo, obituaries of the man. One who made reference to his loving wife, the one who made no reference to his wife. But the winner we're going to give to these, again, go dumb or go home, two police officers in New York State who are accused at a charity golf tournament of running down a woodchuck and crushing him under their golf cart. Evidently, they chased the poor woodchuck until he was exhausted and then ran him over. Really, fellas? Do you not know that people have cell phone cameras? Now they're being investigated for woodchuck homicide. We'll be back with Tim Stanley. Get his perspective on the presidential race. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. Here on this Monday, August 8th, Feast Day of St. Dominic. Pleased to have with us via Skype from London, Timothy Stanley, who is a British blogger, journalist, and historian, writes for the London Daily Telegraph. You'll see him featured in CNN, Catholic Herald, and other publications. He's a lot of fun to follow on Twitter as well. Gracious enough to be with us this morning. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
You've had a busy go of it the last several weeks, including a trip over to Cleveland for your first Republican convention. I would love your observations and thoughts on the American political process via the GOP convention.
I have never been to a convention before, and it's so strange, having worked as a historian for many years and written about dozens of conventions, to actually witness one transforms your understanding of what they are and how they work. And they are obviously primarily a chance to showcase the candidate. But what made this one a little bit unusual is the tension between the candidate and the party. And that's why it was such an interesting one to be at, because you had a sense of two conventions. One, the Republican Party trying to get business done, trying to unify, bring things together. And the other one, of course, was the Donald Trump show. And the very first night, when he introduced his wife by walking out through some clouds of smoke, as though he was appearing on Dancing with the Stars, made you realize that something new has taken over the Republican Party and is really using it as a stage for their own personal performance.
This was not your grandfather's political convention, then?
This is not. I mean, I hadn't been to previous ones, but of course I've had to write about them from a distance. I was in New York during the Republican one in 2012, and the set famously was designed to look like Mitt Romney's front room, although it looked a bit more like a psychiatrist's waiting room. And it was very down to earth, and it was modest, and it was supposed to present Mitt as a perfectly ordinary person. Well, not only can you not present Donald Trump as an ordinary person, but he doesn't like to think of himself as an ordinary person. So this year it was like sitting on sort of the Star Trek Enterprise. There was gold everywhere and big lights, and it was all about signaling the arrival of an entirely new Republican Party.
Having been there, what would you say is the biggest difference between the convention as experienced by the home viewer, who kind of gets the presentation of the convention that maybe they hope that you will get, as opposed to what's happening on the floor and the chatter that you hear?
It's a question of perspective. When you're viewing at home, of course, your eye is upon the speaker. Or else, if you watch some of the coverage as presented by CNN and Fox, they'll keep on breaking into it and giving you very annoying talking heads that actually give very little information whatsoever. If you're sitting there, you can actually look at how the audience reacts to stuff. And that's more like an IMAX experience rather than a cinematic one, because you get a sort of 3D sense of how people are reacting to speakers. Little things matter, like who are people really interested in listening to, or who do they talk over while they're talking, and who do people go out and get themselves a chili dog? Things like that I find absolutely fascinating. But you also, of course, get the buzz immediately outside the hall. You get people immediately reacting to things. You get people gossiping. And you also hear people complaining. And that's something which they're more reluctant to do in front of the TV cameras.
I have to ask what it was like when Ted Cruz gave his speech. That must have been somewhat surreal, especially late in the speech when it became apparent he was not going to endorse Donald Trump.
Yes. I got a little confused because Donald Trump walked in the last 5 minutes, and I actually thought that Trump failed. This is an interesting question of perspective. From where I was sitting, I thought Trump failed to distract people from Ted Cruz's non-endorsement. But I'm told that on the floor itself, actually, he succeeded, and everyone turned around and ignored Cruz for the rest of his speech. It was a very strange speech. So Cruz did this weird halfway thing of coming on, speaking, talking about how one should back the Republican Party, but by not uttering the precise words, "I endorse Donald Trump," he gave a coded indicator that he will not be voting Trump himself personally, and that it's okay for conservatives to do that. On the night, I think that I found a lot of sympathy among many delegates for that position. Many people thought he'd done a brave thing. But in the course of the next couple of days, and I think this might be down to the whipping operation, I don't know what it was, but the delegates really did turn against Cruz. And by the time the Donald spoke on Thursday, people wanted unity. And they found Cruz, they thought Cruz was a wrecker. And in political parties, those people are never very popular.
We're here with Tim Stanley, who is a British journalist, blogger, historian, writes for the Daily Telegraph, CNN, among others. After the convention, it seemed like Donald Trump had some momentum. He had his post-convention bounce. He gave, I think, relatively speaking for Donald Trump, a strong acceptance speech. Since then, it seems like it's been one misstep after another and momentum shifting almost entirely Hillary Clinton's way. Do you think Donald Trump has his opportunity passed, or can he still get momentum back on his side?
When he gave the speech, I thought that's a very good speech. I didn't agree with everything in it, but I had been pretty appalled by the bad management of the convention up until that moment. But I thought, sir, you've just identified the things that people are really talking about and are talking about to me on the streets. And then I thought he had grabbed control of the election, which is where Donald likes to be. He likes to be in the driving seat. The problem is that the Democrat convention, first of all, unified pretty quick after the Bernie Sanders rebellion. Hillary Clinton gave a competent speech, which is all she has to give. But also, Trump reacted to the convention in a bad way, and he made various missteps. And I think that's important to note, that the deflation in his numbers is down to what Trump has done, rather than necessarily what the Democrats have done. So it is within his power to either win or lose the presidency. I still think he has the capacity to win it because of the issue agenda, because he's talking about things which the Democrats are literally not discussing. And the Americans, if you look at all the polls, are on Trump's side on most of those issues. So he still can win it. But we saw after the conventions how he loses it. And how he loses it is by making silly, unguarded comments and picking fights with the parents of dead soldiers. That's how he loses it.
His ego sometimes gets in the way, which he wouldn't be the first politician to have that happen, I'm sure. In the Telegraph piece that you wrote this past Friday, you talked about that, that Trump's candidacy puts Republicans in a fairly awkward position. They have a difficult nominee, but you said there is precedent in how Republicans should deal with that.
There is. They had Barry Goldwater in 1964. I'm not making an ideological comparison. Some people thought I was. Goldwater's a very different kind of conservative to Donald Trump. But you have an eerily similar situation where both Goldwater and Trump were strongly opposed in the primaries. People felt that the Republican Party had made a bad moral decision. And many moderate Republicans in 64 and in 2016 are thinking, if I endorse Goldwater/Trump, will that hurt or help me in the future? Now, in 1964, the decision that most moderates made, the most important of which was Richard Nixon, was to say, I opposed Goldwater, I've taken my stand, but now he's the nominee, I'm going to go all out for supporting him. Now, a lot of the Never Trump people now are saying you can't do that with Trump because he's just too bad a candidate, too immoral and too unconservative. But what they forget is that Trump won those primaries with the largest number of Republican voters ever. So he has a huge well of support. And if you assume he's going to lose this year, when it comes to 2020, the Trump people are still going to be in the party, are still going to be looking for a candidate, and still making trouble. So the Republicans, as they did with Goldwater, have got to find some way of distancing themselves personally from Trump while holding on to his voters and keeping good faith with them. I suspect the Ted Cruz path of simply saying, I want nothing to do with this, that's not going to work for the Republican Party. I can understand why people like Paul Ryan are trying to have it both ways. That's what Nixon did in 64. And in the long run, whichever Republican does that, whichever Republican steals Trump's issues, they're more likely to be the nominee in 2020.
So it's really a balancing act in many ways, is what you're saying.
That's exactly what it is. Having said all of that, again, it's so difficult to maintain your balance when you're dealing with Donald Trump. the fact that he took the fact that he was in two minds about endorsing Paul Ryan in his primaries is something Goldwater would never have done in 1964. Goldwater was also personally a very emollient, charming, intelligent man. He had become swept up by his conservative movement, and he'd also become shielded from the outside world by a group of conservative ideologues. But he was essentially a decent and honorable and nice man. Mm. The difference with Trump is that people struggle to find that personal connection with him because he's so difficult to deal with.
Now, we got about a minute left, Timothy. So you're a Catholic. I'm a Catholic. I mean, what's a Catholic to do in this election? Because it really feels like there's no place to stand in many ways.
It does feel exactly like that. The Libertarian candidate, of course, is pro-choice. And the Democrat candidate is very pro-choice, Hillary Clinton. And Tim Kaine, he is a Catholic, but politically nominally Catholic, Tim Kaine, her vice president, his position on abortion is all over the place. It's very difficult. Catholics just have to pray, and maybe when they vote in November, they have to wear a blindfold. I don't know.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to be with us. And I really, like I said, I enjoy following you on Twitter and your writing, always spot on. It's great to have your perspective. So thanks, and God's blessings to you and to your ongoing work.
You too. God bless.
All right. Take care. We'll be back with more on the other side of the break. He is Timothy Stanley, British journalist, blogger, historian. Always a privilege. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this Feast of St. Dominic, Monday, August 8th. St. Dominic, pray for us. Always enjoy talking with Timothy Stanley. And it's not just the accent, though I will say the accent always gives somebody a little bit more cachet, whether it's British or Australian. Anyway, Tim Stanley, fun to follow on Twitter. You can keep up with all his writing on the Daily Telegraph and CNN and he's got great insights into things as well, particularly from an outsider's perspective. So, and a man of deep faith. I think we've posted before his own explanation of his journey to Catholicism. Pretty powerful. Wanted to have a voice like that. Prominent voice in British media. Certainly British journalism is a great gift for sure. Again, my question of the day, it is Dustin Hoffman's 79th birthday today. So what's your favorite Dustin Hoffman movie? I would probably say that for me, it would be Tootsie. I think I mentioned that earlier. I love that film. There's several that I've not seen that I want to see. I've still not seen The Graduate, I'm embarrassed to say. And Papillon is another one that I have not seen. And a couple of others. Marathon Man, I've only seen the dentist chair scene. So some of Dustin Hoffman's best work. I was telling you about, typically listed among his top films is All the President's Men that he made with Robert Redford playing Woodward and Bernstein from the Watergate investigation, the Washington Post, and so forth. Interesting little side note about Redford and Dustin Hoffman. Evidently, when The Graduate was being cast back in the mid-1960s, director Mike Nichols had a great deal of difficulty casting the part of Benjamin Braddock, which would be the part, of course, Dustin Hoffman would play. When he and Buck Henry were working on the script, Nichols had envisioned Robert Redford in the role. But after a screen test, he realized that Redford could never convincingly play a loser in love. But I guess Hoffman could. Yeah, Robert Redford, no, you're not going to convince us. Nichols says, we tested and tested and tested people and read and read and read people, hundreds of people. We were looking for someone who was sweet and goony. Sweet because he had to do some weird things, and goony because to do those weird things, he couldn't be too self-assured. One month after the talent search began, Nichols found his Benjamin Braddock. He said, I remembered a guy that I saw in a play called Harry Noon and Night, in which he played, believe it or not, a transvestite German fishwife. So obviously, Hoffman's run in Tootsie was not his first trip down the transvestite path. He was remarkable and very funny, so I said, let's test him. He tracked down Hoffman in the midst of an acclaimed run in the British play, Eh? That was the title of it, E.H. question mark, at New York Circle on the Square. When Nichols offered to buy him a drink and invite him to a screen test in L.A., Hoffman was instantly miserable. This is not the part for me, Hoffman thought. I'm not supposed to be in movies. An ethnic actor is supposed to be in ethnic New York in an ethnic off-Broadway show. I know my place. But despite his better judgment, he flew out to Hollywood to screen test, and of course the rest, as they say, is history. But I always wonder if Robert Redford knew that truth and never gave Hoffman a hard time about it. I couldn't be cast because I'd never be convincing as a loser in love. But you, Dustin, not the same. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to chime in with that question of the day. Favorite Dustin Hoffman film. Call or text me, 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. I thought it was interesting what Stanley said, Tim Stanley said, that that ultimately it's going to either be Donald Trump winning this race or Donald Trump losing this race. He is the consequential candidate, so to speak. All Hillary Clinton has to do is basically just keep her car between the white lines. I mean, that's really all she has to do. It's Trump who will determine whether he wins or loses the race. Right now, he's losing it. So we'll see. But I think he illustrated well, too, the dilemma that many Republicans face, as well as the dilemma I think that many Catholics face, who are like me anyway, who find themselves in a position where they cannot vote for either candidate. So anyway, the interesting piece that I happened upon, I don't typically peruse the Huffington Post, but somehow I ended up there. I don't know if I clicked on one thing or another. I think it was because I saw that Marco Rubio was being criticized. Rubio, of course, a senator from Florida, and there is an emerging Zika crisis going on. Of course, Zika, this mosquito-borne communicable disease that has impact on unborn children, or at least they think it does. And Rubio saying that he would not be inclined to support abortion for severe birth defects caused by Zika. And this Huffington Post piece, and if you're familiar with HuffPo, it is a site that that leans pretty hard left on all of its stories, and particularly when it comes to the issue of abortion. And so their criticism of Rubio was that here was a guy who was out of step with the average American voter. And they linked this story, survey story. American voters are much more inclined to support legal late-term abortions if the fetus is afflicted with a severe birth defect caused by the Zika virus, according to a new Stat Harvard poll. The poll found that 59% of Americans favor allowing a woman to obtain a legal abortion after 24 weeks of pregnancy if, and this is how the question was asked, quote, if a woman is infected with Zika virus and a health professional believes there is a serious possibility that the baby would be born with a severe birth defect that includes an abnormally small head and brain damage known as microcephaly. Less than a quarter of respondents favor legal abortion at the same stage of pregnancy when the question does not mention the Zika-related birth defect. In other words, the percentage of U.S. adults who favor allowing a woman to obtain a legal abortion after 24 weeks is 23%. Now, that number in and of itself is pretty horrifying. You're talking about the termination of a pregnancy after viability. You're talking about basically almost full-grown child in terms of an abortion. Now, certainly as Catholics, we believe abortion is morally abhorrent and reprehensible from conception, when the minute human life begins, no matter what the child looks like, because truth is, a child at 6 weeks is every bit as much the human person as a child who is at 24 weeks. They may look different, but that's what a human being looks like at that stage of development. But you have 23% who favor allowing a woman to have an abortion at 24 weeks. But if Zika is involved and there's a serious possibility of microcephaly, 59% of Americans believe that a woman should be able to kill her child simply because the child has some sort of birth defect. And my question would be, what percentage of Americans would believe that infanticide after birth would be acceptable for a child in that situation? And I probably don't want to know the answer to that, to be honest with you. We might all be horrified. As it says here in the story, the Zika virus, which is rapidly spreading throughout South and Latin America and now into Southern Florida, can be transmitted through mosquito sexual contact and from mother to fetus. While it usually causes few side effects, it has been linked to microcephaly in babies. What gets me is how these stories are presented. Like, of course you would believe in this. It really is the wrong question, because the question is, and this happens sometimes on both sides of the equation. I've seen Mark Shea, who has a show on the here at Breadbox Media, highly critical of those on the right who are always talking about when the death penalty might be appropriate, right? Or when carpet bombing enemies may be appropriate. And both the persons in that situation, as well as the persons here who favor and ask these questions about Zika-linked birth defects, are basically asking this question: when do we get to kill? I mean, there's a bloodlust sort of atmosphere to that question. When do we get to kill? Okay, my baby may have microcephaly now, or a woman's baby may have microcephaly. Now, can she get to kill? Is that really the question we should be asking? I mean, talk about the very embodiment of what the late, great St. John Paul II called the culture of death. It is a world that sees death as the answer to difficulty, and sees a child who, through no fault of the child's own, has a terrible condition, that the best treatment, I'm using that in air quotes, of course, of the child is to kill it, because the child can't possibly be loved. The child can't possibly find any joy or happiness. It really is a sad statement about our American values. If that poll, in fact, is true, then come on, U.S., we're better than that. And let's stop asking this question: when do we get to kill? Maybe the question should be, when can we step forward and reveal a love that surpasses difficulties, that triumphs by God's grace? We'll be back with a new hour, including my conversation with Stacey Trusankos. This is The Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.